The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable. The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties, and a lot of those cities, believe it or not, have properties for under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first property out of state in the next 4 months, I encourage you to apply to my out-of-state coaching program. I purchased properties out of state, and it's absolutely changed my life completely. The same is possible for you too. You simply need the right information. That's all it takes. My program will provide you the hands-on support and a step-by-step process to buy that first property within 4 months. So go to outofstatemoney.com to apply today. Again, outofstatemoney.com to apply today, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
Excuse me, may I talk to you for a second? Yes, this is the Black Real Estate Dialogue. And the purpose of the Black Real Estate Dialogue is to document the journey of an up-and-coming real estate investor and to share the stories of successful Black real estate investors.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast, episode 219. Before we get into this episode, a few quick announcements. If you haven't already, make sure you leave a rating and review for the show wherever you're listening to the show. Also, make sure that you are subscribed to this show wherever you listen to the show as well. I'm so excited for this episode today, back with a new interview with Isla Corcoran. Incredible interview. We talk about investing out of state. We talk about creative financing. We talk about how to evaluate an out-of-state market. We even talk about homelessness, the problems of homelessness throughout the country. And we also talk about her experience being a Black woman in real estate. So without further ado, this is going to be a good one. Let's get into it. What's going on, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you're on YouTube, make sure you like this video, subscribe to the channel, leave a comment. Let us know what you think. If you're on the audio side, make sure to leave us a 5-star rating and review. We are live in LA. I'm so excited about this episode. Here with me today, I have Isla Corcoran. Isla, thank you so much. Appreciate you jumping on the show.
Awesome. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course, of course. How are you feeling today?
Feeling good. It's a nice day. We don't have the gloom of LA weather that we've been having, so can't complain.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I'm excited for this episode for many reasons. So we're going to jump right into it. One thing that I always see people talking about is how to creatively finance properties, how to buy properties without a bank, how to buy properties without necessarily needing your credit score or your W-2. Mm-hmm. More specifically, how to actually do seller financing from someone who's not saying it in theory, someone who's actually done it.
Right.
So I definitely would love to start off with that, because I know you have a transaction you did like that in Tulsa, which we'll dive more into Tulsa in particular. But would love if you could just start off with breaking down that deal and how did it come together?
Absolutely. So there's a lot of talk about financing transactions in general, because that's usually the biggest challenge. Apart from finding a property and, you know, putting the deal together, the financing component, especially right now, interest rates being high, and even when interest rates are low, there's always something to be said about, you know, finding the right lender and shopping rates, et cetera. So financing is a huge hurdle. And as someone whose income primarily for the recent past few years has been contractor income or 1099 income, non-W-2 income, essentially, there's even more challenges with qualifying. So, you know, there's limits as to what you can do sometimes to get around them through the bank, you know, because there's still a lot of measures they have to take to assess risk with a borrower. But in my case, really keeping my ear to the ground and my eye on Zillow, essentially looking in markets that I was interested in, is what allowed me to find a deal that enabled seller financing. So in Tulsa, like you mentioned, I had been looking at the market for really about 2 years, just keeping my eye on the inventory, trying to find the perfect opportunity. And there were many deals that could happen, but for whatever reason, I didn't make them happen. And sometimes I think the challenge of having too many options can inhibit many people, including myself. So I think it was a little bit of that, like, analysis paralysis. Like, there's options, but what should I do? When's the right time? How do I finance it, et cetera? But one day, I was doing some more research on different markets to invest in 2024. Evidently, it was at the beginning of the year. And Tulsa had been mentioned as a city that's becoming cool based on some of the infrastructure investment that's been taking place. So it just like piqued my interest again, reignited the interest I already had in the market specifically. And I went on Zillow and immediately found a property. And in the notes, because you can filter on Zillow by keywords, I had filtered by seller financing. And in the notes of one of the properties I found, there was a seller who was specifically asking for a buyer who could use them as the seller to carry the note and pay 10% down and essentially do a 10-year mortgage by the seller. So allow the seller to carry the deed, to carry the note, transfer the deed, and then you would pay monthly for 10 years. And their purpose was they didn't want to pay taxes on all of the proceeds immediately, which makes total sense because it's a huge tax bill. It's from someone who has paid off their property entirely and owns it in full. So that's how I did it. I just reached out to the agent and I got more information on how legit, I guess, the opportunity was, because there's always that concern of like, how are we really going to do this? How is this note going to be recorded? Who am I sending these payments to? You know, how is this all going to work? What qualifications do you have? And after review, it made sense. And again, the terms were 10% down, 10-year loan. Seller carries the note, the deed transfers to me. It's a regular closing like it would be in any other transaction. I just don't have to pay PMI and get to do it all directly with the seller.
Love it. Love it. For those who may not know, what is PMI?
Great question. So PMI is private mortgage insurance. And because I paid less than 20% down, a traditional bank is going to charge a borrower PMI because there's risks associated with a buyer that's so heavily leveraged, which basically means has a higher proportion of debt compared to the their equity. And for most buyers or borrowers, if they are not putting more than 20% down, that insurance is essentially a policy they have to pay for every month to cover the extra risk the bank is taking to lend to you at such a high LTV or loan to value ratio.
Gotcha. And one of the things you mentioned is one of the questions you had during the process is how would the note be recorded? Where would you be sending payments to? Can you talk through some of those details as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was a promissory note, which is basically just a promise to pay a debt. And they have a lien against the property, as a lender would, that says that they are entitled to the debt being satisfied should this title transfer in any way, meaning if I sell the property on title, it'll show that they're a lien holder and they need to be repaid. So they have their I guess, protections in that way. But it's a promissory note, basically a contract that says this is the total amount of the loan and these are when the payments are due, the first of every month, and this is the amount of the payment, and this is the term, and you promise to pay it, and it's signed and notarized at closing. So similar to any other real estate transaction, instead of signing all those pages of lender paperwork, it was like a lot shorter, and it was still essentially saying the same thing, but just between me and the former owner directly.
Love it. And what was the interest rate on that?
The interest rate, I believe, was 6.75. Okay. So it was market interest. I bought it in January. So it was within market. But the good thing is it's a 10-year note. So the value I saw there was it's a shorter period of time, shorter amortization schedule, which means a shorter schedule for me to start paying off interest and then slowly paying off the actual loan. And I was given the option to refinance at any point, which was a large question mark that I had in the beginning, just to make sure that I would not have a prepayment penalty and I would be able to refinance if I had a more favorable rate or wanted to, you know, extend the time of my loan for whatever reason. But yes, it was 6.75%.
Love that. And it's crazy because a lot of people talk about interest rates and things of that nature. I tell people that it's not really the rate. Mm-hmm. It's if you're trying to generate cash flow, if you can generate your return, I don't think the rate really matters. What are your thoughts on that?
Every market has its own challenges and nuances. Mm-hmm. When rates were lower, prices were inflated and people were complaining that you're overpaying for a home because there's so many buyers, money is so cheap and drives up the price, which looking at like economic cycles, that is traditionally what happens when there's more money available for cheaper in the economy, in the world, or in the country. It's easier for people to buy more things, people spend more money, and prices go up. So it's the same thinking with real estate. So it just kind of depends what challenge you want to face. Do you want to overpay but pay less in interest, or do you want to pay fair market value, pay more in interest? And it's also relative because it's completely subjective. And I think your goal is the biggest factor, meaning if your goal is to own real estate, putting it off for a better rate doesn't get you any closer to a positive outcome because no one can see the future. And if you get a mortgage with a 10-year timeline or a 30-year timeline, once you get it, once those 10 years or 30 years pass, assuming you make your payments, you own it. Yeah. So if you can see that as your goal, assuming that is your goal, then the rate becomes a little less relevant, assuming you can cash flow or cover the mortgage at whatever number it's at.
That makes sense. So at the end of the 10 years, will the debt be satisfied, or is there like a balloon payment at the end? How does that part work?
Great question. There's no balloon payment. Okay. At the end of the 10 years, the debt is entirely satisfied. I have the option to refinance at any point if I want to replace my loan, but I'm really thinking that the way that I look at my strategy right now, the sooner I can pay off my properties, the better. And having a shorter loan timeline allows me to get closer to cash flowing more so. So that's how I'm looking at it right now. It's my goal.
Love that. So it sounds like at a high level, folks can start on Zillow or like mm-hmm. whatever their website of choice is and look in the notes for sale by owner or seller finance, something like that. And then of course, like work with an attorney, make sure all the paperwork and the terms are, it just really depends like what you agree to with the seller and go from there.
Yeah, I'd say having great advisors, if you're using a real estate agent or if you're in an attorney closing state or if you're using an attorney to review the paperwork, depending on whatever the circumstances and wherever you're looking, and your comfort in reviewing these kind of documents, my background being in real estate and having some experience with specialty finance in my career allowed me to, I think, take this on more comfortably. Not everyone has the same experience, but I wouldn't want anyone to shy away from it for that reason, because there's a great opportunities to find a good deal and make it come together in a kind of out of the box way, but still cover your bases and protect yourself. So yeah, to your point, like having your ear to the ground, always looking, always researching, looking for opportunities to invest or buy properties, because most of the times the right opportunities don't just come to you when you're expecting it. They kind of come, you know, when they just do. So yeah, keeping your eyes open and finding the right advisors to help you make it happen.
Awesome. Did the seller have an agent representing them?
He did.
How does a seller's agent get compensated in this kind of scenario? Because I don't think we've really covered too much with people doing like creative finance mm-hmm. where there's agents involved. I've heard a lot, and we've had people, you know, go direct to seller and kind of work it out between them. But I think it's interesting that an agent was involved.
There was an agent involved, and the agent was compensated pretty standardly. They had a listing agreement. I think the commission rate was 5% total split on both sides.
Gotcha.
But I actually let the seller's agent, the listing agent, represent me.
Okay.
So I negotiated a referral fee because I'm an agent. So I was able to get a referral fee from the listing agent for referring myself to them as a client. And that reduced some of my transaction costs and allowed them to represent both sides and maximize their commission.
Oh, we got to break that down. I haven't heard that before. So you're an agent, of course, mm-hmm. and you referred yourself to an agent who represented both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Walk through that, because I'm kind of blown away by that.
Yeah. So basically, and I've done this a couple times in different circumstances. This circumstance specifically was unique because I was the buyer. So I came to the listing agent and I told them I was interested in buying the property. And I asked them if they'd be willing to submit an offer for me as a buyer. Now, not all states allow dual representation. This particular situation, it was allowed. Their broker either approved it or it's already allowed in Oklahoma. something along those lines. And so they were willing to submit the offer for me, and I asked for a referral fee. And in most cases, referral fees can only be paid broker to broker, meaning their broker pays my broker and then it trickles down to me as an agent. If I wasn't a licensed agent, I wouldn't be entitled to a referral fee. But because I was, it was really just a negotiation thing. I was like, hey, I'm an agent and I'm allowing you to represent me instead of going to another agent. So can I get X amount? I think it was like, I think I asked for like $2,500 as a referral fee, and we did it as a credit. So that's how it ended up working out. It was a credit against my closing costs and down payment.
That's some game right there for the agents out there.
Yeah, seriously.
I love that. What was the purchase price of the property?
It was $200,000.
Dope. It's a single family?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Dope. So what's the exit strategy? Is it a long-term rental at this point? Like what are your plans for it?
I really think that I'm a buy and hold investor. Mm-hmm. I love the appreciation component of real estate and the fact that the value increases. I think that a big challenge that specifically Black Americans have faced in this country is not being able to have ownership and leverage equity for their financial stability. So knowing that I have assets that have value that I can leverage later in life, since we don't know what's going to happen, and you know, maybe I need to take out some money for really any number of things that I could want or desire in the future, I like the idea of having that option and having the cash flow. So yeah, I'm a buy and hold investor for the most part. I want to keep it until it's free and clear, and then I'm cash flowing every month, and then I can leverage it in whichever way to add to my portfolio, support my dreams, my goals, my life, whatever that looks like.
Definitely. I love that. Love that. Do you need to do any like rehab or anything to that property, or is it kind of turnkey?
It was completely turnkey. I got tenants in there pretty immediately, within like 3 weeks. So yeah, it was ready to go.
Love it. And you're self-managing, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's one thing I want to talk about.
Yeah,
as we spoke before, like I invest out of state too. We're kind of like pretty much at the same stage in many cases. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk more about the self-management piece, because what I think is it's not that difficult. There are some points where you have to do stuff, but if you pick a good person, it's really not mm-hmm. that difficult the majority of the time.
Mm-hmm.
I want to hear your perspective mm-hmm. and also why you decided to self-manage, because we're here in LA mm-hmm. and you're investing in Tulsa and also in Texas, which we'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
But what's your take on it?
So it's hard to find people to trust with your assets. It can be. There's great people out there. But when you're out of state, you feel, I think, a little bit more distant and detached from what's actually going on. And I wanted to have the initial control and oversight. That way, longer term, even if I do transition this to somebody else or to a third party, I had an understanding of how my property worked, what the general needs were, who I use, vendor relationships. Building relationships is super value in all things. In every aspect of your life, your network and your relationships really take you far. So especially when it comes to having out-of-state properties, I wanted to be able to establish that network for myself of the plumbers and the electricians and the gardeners and the folks that I could build relationships with, give business to, and hopefully long term make that easier even for a third party management company who comes in, and also make it easier for me to understand how things work and what to expect cost wise. And that was my initial thought going into real estate property management, actually, because when I started my real estate career, I started it as a property manager. And my entire thinking was, I need to be able to understand how to manage properties. That way, when I own my property, I'll be able to manage it and not get, you know, ripped off or something. I was like kind of concerned about what that would look like, especially being a minority in the field and feeling like I want to know what I'm doing and protect myself. So I started with property management with the goal to be able to self-manage. So when I got my properties, I was like, okay, now I got to really, really go for it. And I think people would be surprised, people who haven't done it before would be surprised with how easy it can be. Of course, there are challenges. And when there are challenges, there's a huge range as to how dramatic they can be. But more often than not, knock on wood, it goes well. And most days are pretty seamless. So yeah.
We got a lot to unpack there. So your career start in property management, I think, is crucial, because your reasoning for it was, when it's time for you to buy properties and manage properties, you'll know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it's great that you did that, because a lot of times people might have fear about those things and mm-hmm. never do them, but you really leaned into it before you even were able to buy a property mm-hmm. and thereby preparing you for when your time came. Mm-hmm. So I think that's crucial, and I'm sure you learned a whole ton from that. I would love to hear from you, what are some tips you can provide to someone who wants to self-manage, whether they're local, whether they're long distance? What are some things they should have in place to make sure that they can run things efficiently? And I'm also asking for myself too.
Yeah. So I honestly think having a general mindset of creativity and being open to exploring different solutions really helps, because the biggest resources for me have been all the apps. Like, I've used Yelp and Thumbtack and TaskRabbit or Tasker or whatever it's called now, where basically you can have people run errands for you, and used Facebook Marketplace. I've had to furnish properties, just all the different apps and the things. Get acquainted with them, especially if you're out of state, and going into it as you're buying a property, know that you need to have some funds earmarked for ancillary needs or expenses. Both of my properties have been a little bit different. With my first property, I went a few different directions. I had roommates. I had it on Airbnb. I did it a few different ways, which required me to be a little bit more hands-on with like furnishing and utilities. With my second property, I pretty much listed it and said, tenant handles everything. I handle, you know, provide making sure the space is ready for you when you move in. And kind of kept it a little bit more stripped down in terms of how much I was providing. So for that reason, like, I've had to have different levels of involvement and different levels of investment as well, of time and money. But finding local resources and starting with those apps really helps you find local resources. So I really appreciated that. Also, whoever you use to represent you on your transaction, assuming you have a realtor, or even if it's a listing agent for the property, try to build a rapport with them. They're local. They understand the market. They probably do some property management. They could probably help you with leasing. So those are the kind of things, when I say like relationships and network has a lot of value, I would lean into whatever resources allow you to expand that network, especially in the beginning.
I love that. And one thing I expected you to mention, I'm glad you did, mm-hmm. was the importance of leveraging other people, leveraging mm-hmm. technology and things like that, because you have your life here. Mm-hmm. You're not about to get on a plane to Tulsa mm-hmm. or to Texas to take care of something somebody else could do, right? Mm-hmm. So I agree, and I think that's important. And I think also too, I'm with you on having, because I have, they pay the utility to take care of all that stuff, and I just need to make sure to fix stuff when it's broken. Mm-hmm. I think that makes it a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad you mentioned that as well. Yeah. And I would encourage people to consider that, because your cash flow is more predictable, unless, you know, something needs to be fixed or whatever the case is. Mm-hmm. And it's also one less thing for you to worry about, bill for you to think about. So I like that you mentioned that as well.
Yeah, I think that really helps reduce the amount of variables to consider when you just get the property ready, allow them to move in, take care of most of the things, and then you are just responsible for the, you know, fixing and some maybe maintenance. That really helped in this second process remove some of the unexpected question marks, I guess, and variables that ended up coming up, and the costs. I will say too, when you're buying out of state, in most cases, you're doing so because it's more affordable for you as an investor and there's more opportunity. And that also in some ways will require you to pay for convenience, and convenience meaning local people who can do things when you can't. So there's a little bit of a trade-off, but if it allows you to get a property, it has great value, of course, to participate in that trade-off, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Have you had any property management nightmares? I have, but I want to hear, want you to share yours.
Yeah, I've had some property management nightmares. I think doing short-term rentals was a good exposure exercise to things that can go wrong, because I've had people misrepresent how they want to use the property. I've had people misrepresent how many people are going to be there, how many animals are going to be there, you know, what activities they're going to be partaking in. I've had people specifically throw events that were not authorized and break TVs, break tables, break chairs, ruin carpet, just have tons of people in the home and basically disregard the property entirely and just kind of disrespect it. So, and that actually happened right before Christmas too, a couple years back. So it was a nightmare, but I think having that disposition of this is what I signed up for, to be able to have a property and deal with the good and the bad. And I exposed myself to this risk by renting it out on short-term rental. And, you know, there are certain precautions in place through whatever platforms you use that allow you to recover sometimes in these situations. But yeah, these kind of nightmares are sometimes par for the course. And it's not fun, but I learned a lot through them. So, you know, it is what it is.
Short-term rentals. Mm-hmm. I don't like short-term rentals.
I understand.
Do you think it's something that you would do again? And the reason I don't like short-term, and it can be great. Mm-hmm. Let me make that disclaimer. Short-term rentals can be great. You can make a lot of money. We've had people on the show make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying not to do it. I just don't like it because to me, it's too hands-on. And, mm-hmm. you know, you got to check this person out in and out or whatever. It's just, I like simplicity. Mm-hmm. And predictability. Obviously, you can make way more money with a short-term rental. Is this something that you will consider doing again?
Good question. I was on a panel this week and we talked about diversifying your real estate portfolio. And I think one specific way you can diversify is different properties with different uses. So I do see the value in having properties with different uses, whether it's long-term rentals, short-term rentals, events, retail, whatever, multifamily, long-term rentals, mixed short-term, whatever it is, because all of these use cases are affected differently by market conditions. And we saw a period of time where short-term rentals had a great run. And ultimately, the tides kind of changed. People had less excess income to be able to travel and go to these short-term rentals. The value, because the market became so saturated, of these rentals was becoming a little bit more in question because people weren't having great experiences on the consumer end. And a lot of people just kind of thought anyone can run a short-term rental. So again, the market can change and the economy can change and property performance will be affected. I will say at that same time, a lot of folks were having challenges with renters because of COVID and how the eviction moratorium and other just the natural side effects of a global pandemic and really strenuous financial times we're having on individuals and renters and then homeowners, et cetera. So because of the ebb and flow of the market, I see where short-term rentals have provided value to property owners to leverage in times where other use cases for their property weren't as successful. But it's a job. Having a short-term rental is not a passive type of property ownership. It's a job, assuming you're self-managing, which I was. And it's also in some ways a little bit of a service because you have to communicate with them consistently. And a lot of times it's travel and, you know, they want a nice experience, which is understandable. So it's my long-winded way of saying I would consider it, but, and I think it can serve a purpose, but anything when saturated can make it really hard for everyone else and also have significant effects on the housing market in general. And I don't love it and I don't see it as something that I would want to do again in the near future. for my properties that I own. Yeah.
Definitely. And the short-term rental was the one in Texas, right?
Mm-hmm.
So was that your initial goal when you bought it, was to do short-term rentals, or was it long-term? When you bought it, what was the goal?
When I bought it, I wanted to do long-term, and I was renting it out to roommates. I was renting out each room to different individuals, which worked really well in some ways. And when you have the right mix of people, it can work really well. Also, it's not without its challenges, but I decided at some point I would transition to short-term rentals based on the cash flow opportunity and what was seemingly a market need, because my property size, it was a larger property, or is a larger property, and can accommodate a larger group. And generally speaking, those are harder to find on an Airbnb or a Vrbo or whatever platform you use. So that was my initial thought. And yeah, my thought process has just evolved as I've learned whether I was doing roommates or long-term, entirely rented out, or short-term. I've played around with what was the best way based on whatever my current goal was.
That makes sense. How large is the house?
It's 4 bedrooms.
Oh, that's pretty big. That's pretty big. And the reason I ask that is because I believe you did it the right way, because your initial goal was long-term.
Mm-hmm.
There's honestly no harm in trying different stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You did the roommates, you did the short term, and you still might do the midterm one day in the future too.
Mm-hmm.
But you know it'll always work if you want to revert back to long term.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really see a downside in testing the different things to see what you want to do, knowing that the tried and true long term rental, it's still going to work. You're going to cash flow. You'll be fine. I think it's better for people to do it that way,
mm-hmm,
than to just buy a property with the sole purpose of using it as a short-term rental. And if the short-term rental is the only situation in which the numbers are going to work,
mm-hmm,
that is a dangerous place to be. And to me, based on what I've seen over the last couple of years, it seems like a lot of people made that mistake of, I'm buying this property just for short-term rental. I don't know if it's going to work for long-term or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Then that market gets saturated, or the city starts cracking down,
mm-hmm,
on those Airbnbs, which has happened, or short-term rentals, which has happened in various cities and is probably more regulation to come.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think whenever you go into a business venture, even outside of real estate, it's important to give yourself a margin for error or for things to go differently, maybe. Because I don't want to say wrong, because hopefully you learn from it and it helps you later. But I definitely bought the property with a margin for figuring out what was going to happen. Meaning, if I'm not cash flowing immediately, I would be fine. And I think more people should go into business ventures or real estate with the understanding or ability to withstand times where you're at a detriment or where you're at a loss, because many businesses are cyclical and will face downturns and will face, you know, you have to account for vacancy, etc. So I agree. A lot of people went into the short-term rental market with this idea of get rich quick, or I'm going to make a ton of money and all I have to do is get an apartment and throw some furniture and whatever and hope for the best. But they didn't have a plan for if the best doesn't happen. And I think that's the big issue, is sometimes it's not going to go the best way. And if the best way is also the only way that it can work, yeah, you're setting yourself up for really no flexibility, no adaptability.
Definitely. I really like that you mentioned just the margin for if things don't go as planned.
Mm-hmm.
Because even some people say, I can rent for $1,500, because that's the max I see in my market, and they think it's guaranteed that they're going to get that. I don't think that's good either.
Mm-hmm.
To your point, you, however you want to do it, just factor in, maybe it could be, does this deal still work if it's $100 less or $200 less? And
mm-hmm,
with all my, you know, all the calculations, I think it's very important.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good to be optimistic, right?
Like, yeah.
However, you have to prepare, like you said, for different potential scenarios. So I hope y'all.
The reality for many of you is that investment properties where you live have become absolutely unaffordable.
The good news is that there are many cities with affordable properties, and a lot of those cities, believe it or not, have properties for under 100K. If you're someone who's ready to buy your first property out of state in the next 4 months, I encourage you to apply to my out-of-state coaching program. I purchased properties out of state, and it's absolutely changed my life completely. The same is possible for you, too. You simply need the right information. That's all it takes. My program will provide you the hands-on support and a step-by-step process to buy that first property within 4 months. So go to outofstatemoney.com to apply today. Again, outofstatemoney.com to apply today. And I look forward to talking to you soon.
Grabbed on, held on to that, you know?
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit more about out-of-state investing. Obviously, we are in one of the most expensive cities in the country,
mm-hmm.
right? And this is my own opinion, I'm saying. And it's not a favorable place here for landlords,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion,
mm-hmm.
mom and pop in particular. So what made you want to invest out-of-state?
For me, investing out-of-state was seemingly my only option. So it was more like, I know that there are two tried and true ways historically to generate wealth: investing in public equities and investing in real estate. And the value of your money is going to shrink over time, period. There's nothing I can do about it. So I need to figure out a way to fight against that, to essentially protect against inflation and generate assets. And again, those two methods being the tried and true ways to generate wealth, I was kind of like, well, whether or not I like the idea of buying out of state, buying in state, investing in the market, having to play the game in that way, it was sort of null and void, because I was either going to put myself in a poor financial situation long term. This is my feeling, I guess, about where I was. Put myself in a poor financial situation long term by not taking the opportunity to try and push myself to get assets and generate assets for myself and my family long term. So, because I knew those things to be true, I started investing in public equities, and I wanted to get into real estate, but I couldn't afford California, couldn't afford, much less Los Angeles, which is where I live. So out of state felt like the single option that I had. Then the question became, out of the states that are affordable, where do I want to go? And kind of doing that research. But it was really more for me, like, I know that I need to invest in order to generate wealth. And if I don't, then my money's value will decrease, and saving is not enough in this world, unfortunately. So I have to figure it out. And out of state is the only option, it felt like.
What were your fears before you were able to buy that first property?
I experienced foreclosure growing up in my household. We lost the home that we owned, or the condo that we had bought and lived in for some time and then lost. So I think there were some limiting beliefs that stemmed from that experience, and whether or not I would be capable of doing it, of getting a property. The other fears that come into play when you're particularly getting a property out of state are, what if I'm not going to be close enough to be able to deal with it or whatever? To be honest, I felt like I was in a position where I could afford it because the price was low enough. So I felt like I'm putting money into a piggy bank for myself. That's the way I saw it, because every dollar that I paid towards my mortgage would ultimately go towards some interest and also building equity. So I saw it as, if nothing else, this is a savings account for me. And when I thought about it that way, the fears were a little bit less of an inhibiting component, because I knew I'm paying myself. So what am I losing? It's money going to my pocket, even if the house is vacant forever, which, of course, other issues could come from that. But that in my frame of mind at that point, I was really just thinking about the need to do it and what that would bring me.
I'm really glad you, thank you for your transparency.
Yeah.
And it's important for people to hear that, because the reality of it is, so many people watching are living in places where it's just, you can barely afford to buy groceries, right? So mm-hmm. places like California, Miami, New York City, the Bay Area, Seattle, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So many people live in these places and they just feel stuck. And there's a way out through investing out of state, which I advocate heavily for, because to your point, it's important to invest in those assets. It's important to build that wealth. And similarly, when I was a kid, we lost back in New York, we lost our home too, mm-hmm. right? So I had that thought in my head too. Mm-hmm. And it's real. Mm-hmm. It's real. Like, we all have things we fear.
Yeah.
However, I think it's best to lean into that and persist and just know that you'll figure things out.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of risk in not taking risk. Mm-hmm. I always try to remind people when they ask me for my opinion or my advice, when you aren't taking a risk, you're still subjecting yourself to the risk of inflationary risk or the risk of a missed opportunity, et cetera. And standing still or being complacent or not trying to seek out other options doesn't protect you. I know it can be much easier said than done to put yourself out there in any way, especially when it comes to putting your money out there. And most of us work so hard to even have money in the first place. So the idea of putting it at risk is so scary and concerning, but it's at risk regardless, unfortunately, because it's just getting more expensive. Inflation's continuing to go up and continue to affect us, whether or not it goes up year over year. But ultimately, it still has an impact, and we're going to need money for the rest of our life. So we're sort of realistically left to figure out what to do with it so that we can make our life easier later. And not doing anything just prolongs that problem. It doesn't protect you, unfortunately.
Definitely. What's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
What's really the absolute worst that could happen?
Yeah. I mean, it's true. There's a lot of horror stories that people have had and bad outcomes that are valid. But the end of the day, if the other option is just continuing to kind of skate by or, you know, not really get out of the situation that you're in, you're kind of in a position where you're either going to stick to where you're at or try to change your situation, fail, and be, you know, potentially back in the same place and with a lot more lessons. So, and having great advisors is a big part of that, because they're able to say, this is the worst that could happen, so let's not do this. Or these are the different outcomes that you should expect or protect against or prepare for, and this is how you do it. And there is help out there, and, you know, there's people that will talk to you, and they're not, you know, always going to charge you. There's people that want to give you support and advice and help you improve your situation. So seeking that out is really valuable so that you don't have to spiral into the worst that could happen. You could kind of know, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. When did you buy the property in the Dallas area?
So that was like 2019. Okay. No, it was 2020.
Dope.
Yeah. 2020.
Dope. And what, so you knew you wanted to invest out of state. There's plenty of places where you can get started. What made you want to start in the Dallas area?
It was 2020 when I reserved the lot. And then I closed at the beginning of 2021. And I had decided on Dallas because I had done some research on markets that had a lot of new infrastructure development. And Dallas was already pretty popular, but there were new incentives for people to move there, new companies that were headquartered there, new schools that were being built. In the particular suburb just on the outskirts of Dallas where I purchased, there was like 7 schools in the proximate area that were being built. So that was an indicator for me that families are coming here, people are being established here. This is a market that's getting built out. There's a lot of development here, period, not just of homes. So the opportunity for appreciation is present there. It's there. So that was my thought process around Dallas. It was close enough by plane that I felt comfortable because it wasn't on the East Coast or as far as, I guess, some of the other states I could have invested in. And the opportunity just seemed significant. So I felt like I'm either going to keep putting ideas around through my head or just jump in.
I love that. And that story made me think about something. I've seen people say that if you're just getting started out or just in general, you shouldn't buy a property that you can't drive to within a reasonable amount of time. And the first thing I think about is, well, we live in California,
mm-hmm.
and the places where it's cheap to buy, we can't drive.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get out of here with that.
Yeah.
You know, but to your point though, a few hour plane ride is nothing if something happens.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned just the bill. You mentioned reserving a lot. Was this a new construction property?
Yes. Yes. I didn't mention that. This was a brand new construction. So I reserved the lot in fall of 2020. It was completed at the beginning of 2021. And I went the new construction route because I felt like I would have the warranty and the resources to, for at least the first year, mm-hmm. handle anything that went wrong, because I knew, being out of state, also not really being the most handy woman myself, I didn't really want the responsibility of an old roof or a old plumbing system or anything that was faulty to be my responsibility immediately. And I wasn't prepared to take on significant repair costs. I didn't want to have to take those on. So new construction was the route I took.
Got it. What was that process like while they were building the property? Like, what was it like for you? Because it's different from, you know, you see something on Zillow, you connect with an agent or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, that whole process versus I reserved this lot, y'all are going to build this house, and this is going to be my rental property. What was that process like?
When I was waiting, it was honestly really exciting because they would send me pictures and be like, the foundation's being, you know, poured in and being built out, and now we have the framing, and it's looking like a house now, and like sending pictures. And I had pictures of myself at the lot when I had reserved it, and it was nothing. It was just dirt. Wow. So it was really cool to take a picture with, like, I found like a flower that was growing in like the dirt that would eventually be a home. And I took a picture with it and I kept it. And then the next time I went, it was a whole neighborhood, actually. It wasn't just wow. my house, because there were so many houses that were built in that time that it went from a dirt lot to a real community. So it was really exciting for me. It was my first property, so everything about it felt so new. So it was fun. I liked it a lot.
That's so dope. That's so dope. And one thing you mentioned, which I really hope people caught on to, is just the investing in a growing area,
mm-hmm.
and not a place that's declining, because you can find plenty of places with properties that are affordable. However,
mm-hmm.
if that's what if you're only basing it on that, you could find yourself in some big trouble. So I'm glad that you mentioned just what you observed specifically and just seeing that, you know, things are growing. I'm sure it wasn't hard to find that kind of information either, because what I've found is that cities who are doing those kind of things, like, they want people to buy, they want people to move, they want people to invest. So they're going to publicize all this stuff, mm-hmm. which makes it much easier for you.
Yeah, exactly. It makes it easy. You can see what the trends are. You can see where communities are growing. Mm-hmm. You can see press releases where companies say that they're moving or developing a new property there or whatever it is, and creating opportunities or creating jobs. So it was pretty easy to find that information. And just kind of going back to what I said before too, like, knowing that the other option was either not buying anything or waiting, I felt like I can't really go too far from my target, because my target is to get a property that long term I can use as an asset and can cash flow and can help me fund my retirement. So all I have to do is find a house that I can afford. I made it really easy for myself to accomplish my goal. I didn't have the goal of, I need to make $5,000 a month in passive income starting next month, and I need this house to be filled immediately, and I need, you know, all of these boxes to be checked. And the property also I have to get for the best price, has to be the best home on the market or whatever. I didn't have all those boxes to check. My one box was a house that I can afford, so that after 30 years, I can own it, hopefully sooner, and use it to help me fund my life and have appreciation. So try to make it as simple as I could so that I couldn't miss my target, unless I really tried to miss my target.
Yeah, I like that. And in my opinion, let me know if you agree with this.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you had this 15, 20 things that it had to have before you purchased it, you probably wouldn't have bought it. You probably would have talked yourself out of it.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's so much advice out there. There's so many things that people will tell you to do or not to do. I think the more important thing to consider is, what's the risk of not doing it? Meaning, okay, I could get this house, but it won't have what I want. What's the risk of not getting the house at all? Okay, it's way worse than the risk of not having the one thing I need. So yes, you know, maybe I'm not getting exactly what I wanted, but I'm getting a better outcome than I would have had. And I think people focus too much on what they're not getting in a situation, in an investment or whatever it is, instead of why is this, although slightly maybe less favorable or not perfect, better than the alternative? And when you weigh the options or the opportunity cost, usually the option that you have in front of you, even if it's not the most perfect, is potentially a lot better. So that's what I try to encourage myself to think about, because I do get overwhelmed when I have too many options in front of me.
Very good self-awareness.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Definitely. So Dallas was first, then Tulsa. Mm-hmm. We touched on it a little bit, but of course, you know, we know the significance Tulsa has in the Black community. What was it about Tulsa and where it's headed that got you really interested in expanding and making an investment there?
When I was doing some research, I also saw, similarly to what I had seen in Dallas, that there was infrastructure investment that the municipality was supporting to build out the community. There's a lot of new programs, new companies and organizations that are headquartering in Tulsa or bringing people to Tulsa. And there's a lot of conscious investment into the community of Tulsa that I've seen. Plus, it was so affordable that I felt like even if this perception I have of the community being on the brink of an emergence from, you know, maybe being less favorable or whatever it was, even if I'm not correct, I have so much time. I felt like to see that investment build and mount. So I felt comfortable. Again, being a buy and hold investor, I have that long term time horizon. So I have the flexibility to say, okay, even if, you know, this home doesn't appreciate so significantly so quickly, I'm still on track. But I did see a lot of infrastructural investments being made, developments to the walkability of the community, the parks, the different things that make a community. And like you said, the Black history of it being Black Wall Street and being torn down and burned down, and the significance I think there is to reclaiming that Black excellence and ownership in the community. I think there's a lot of power in all those things. So I was super interested in the market for, I guess, multiple reasons.
Definitely. So you're an agent, mm-hmm. you're an investor, you do a whole lot mm-hmm. of other things. What is it like being a Black woman in that space? Because there's not many doing what you're doing and what you're aspiring to continue doing in the future.
Being a Black woman in the space is empowering, but it is not without, I guess, challenges. I mean, being a Black woman in general, I think there's that experience of being sometimes discredited or overlooked or not always considered or taken seriously. And I experienced that a lot, or I have experienced that a lot in my career and in different places I've been. But I try to reclaim that as my power, being younger in certain communities or being a minority in that community. It can feel like the thing that makes me stick out or less valuable in sometimes other people's eyes. But when you kind of reclaim that as that's the what I can leverage as part of my identity and just who I am and my truth, I think has helped me kind of push through the imposter syndrome that can come with it. But I really enjoy being community minded and thinking about how the decisions I make as an individual investor, advisor, agent, et cetera, human, impact my community. And I try to bring that consideration into spaces that I think that consideration has not been included. So I try to wield that as my power too, that I'm bringing a perspective that majority of people in this space might not have. And that is something to be proud of, and also a big responsibility that I get to I guess, hold. Yeah.
I love that. How has your career impacted your investing and just some of the things you want to do? And if you could just share a bit more about, because we only touch on a little bit what you do a whole lot. So if you could touch more on some of the other things you do as well.
Yeah, I think so. I really feel like my career and who I am is rooted in my belief in housing and third spaces and community development. So I'm really passionate about those things. I dedicate a lot of my time to nonprofit work. Shout out to Imagine LA, local here in Los Angeles. We work with folks emerging from homelessness and supporting them and also supporting the solution to the challenges that threaten housing stability or housing security for a lot of the community. So whether that's mental health challenges or living wage opportunities or access to certain information or resources, trying to address those needs as opposed to just putting a Band-Aid on an issue. So I try to dedicate a lot of my time to that work. I also really enjoy investing in other businesses, and I'm super interested in how hospitality and third spaces allow us as a community of all people, and including the Black community especially, to find support. I think when we talk about diversification in your portfolio of investments, there's also a lot of value in diversifying your perspective. So through traveling, through attending events, through watching things like this, through meeting people, those are all ways I think people can diversify their perspective and really get themselves outside of their situation and into considering all the options there are for them. So angel investing is a part of what I do. Advising, I've been a financial advisor. I've been a licensed investment advisor for a few years now. So it's a component of what I do as well. But yeah, I started out in real estate because I was like, all rich people have real estate. So I should probably figure that out and figure out how to get real estate or learn about it. And I think that put me in so many spaces to learn about different ways to invest in myself and others, which is the thing that I enjoy the most.
Love that. Love that. Homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get more of your thoughts on that. It's a very frustrating issue here. And I'm sure many other cities can empathize with this. You're involved like on the ground to a tremendous degree. So I'm very curious to hear your thoughts on this question. To me, it seems like a lot of Band-Aids are being put on the issue and it's, you know, people are being pacified, but at scale, there's not enough being done for those who are ready for, who want the support to move forward with their lives.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think I'm making an inaccurate assessment based on what you see out there?
I really think one of the biggest issues that we haven't, for whatever reason, at a policy level, considered significantly enough is the broken benefit system. I think the problem is people have certain resources, like maybe you have a certain voucher for your housing and then a separate voucher for food or other resources or childcare, et cetera. But these are all systems that don't communicate with each other. So when someone gets to a better situation or they have more stability because they have some of their housing costs covered and their childcare covered and they can work more, for example, but their income reaches a certain point where maybe they make one more dollar an hour and that disqualifies them from a significant amount of their benefits. That is not incentivizing to anyone. If I'm going to make another dollar per hour and maybe that translates to, you know, I guess $40 a week, but I'm going to lose $500 a month in resources that I was getting, why would I? That's not a trade-off that makes sense. And then it perpetuates the system. So I think the problem is our benefit system, to your point, puts a lot of Band-Aids instead of interweaving the support so that people have more visibility, one, on where they're at in the system, what they're even entitled to, what they're qualified for, and how they can leverage it to get to a better place. And also the true fact is a lot of times when people get into a more stable place, for example, they go from off the street to from on the street to in housing off the street. A lot of the issues that put them maybe on the street in the first place start to affect them again. Your basic needs become met. So the mental health challenges maybe that you experience or other challenges that someone might experience as a result of trauma will come to the surface. So we need more solutions that address those root issues too and don't criminalize them. So it's to your point, like you said, a lot of band-aids versus understanding how we've created a system that doesn't allow people to be incentivized to move forward in their career because they're at risk of being criminalized or losing everything that they've worked so hard to build, you know?
Instead of someone losing a certain benefit because they make a dollar more, mm-hmm. wouldn't it make more sense to do it almost on like a sliding scale type of thing? So like, as you make more money, maybe we can decrease something in accordance to you going up in life until you're fully able to sustain yourself, which it takes a lot to do here.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that make more sense?
I totally agree.
Person to like independence?
I totally agree. I definitely think a sliding scale would make sense. I also think a more honest conversation about living wages is important because people lose benefits when they reach wages that are still not living wages. So that's a huge problem because it's not a living wage for an individual, much less a family, which at least the population I work with tends to be exclusively families. So if you're losing significant amount of your benefits, also not making a minimum wage, I mean, people that do make a living wage in theory can't afford to buy in LA, can barely afford to rent in LA, and maybe are renting with roommates and still barely making it to pay for all the other needs they have. So it's not easy for anyone. Most Americans are not more than $600 away from a significant financial hardship. So if everyone's living paycheck to paycheck, why would we expect for people who are actively using the support of certain benefits to be able to manage a cliff where their benefits drop off so significantly? So I agree, a sliding scale makes more sense. Resources like mental health support and job training are really important. In communities I've worked with, we've seen families go through job programming, whether it's at a college or a sort of a trade school, and significantly increase their income, like by 111%, and truly end their cycle of poverty. And then that opens the door for someone else who can maybe use vouchers they were initially on, but they need to be able to support themselves truly in order for that cycle to kind of not perpetuate so much.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And it's crazy because I look at data like all the time, and when I saw that the median household income in LA was $75,000 at the last census, an individual can barely get by with that in this mm-hmm. city, right? And so if that's the median, then that means half of the people make less.
Yeah.
I don't know how people are making it. I really don't.
Yeah, it's startling because the minimum income needed to sustain a living wage in LA is actually greater than the median household income. So that's a huge problem because if, again, half of the people are making less, plus even at the median, we're still not above the line of being able to cover our basic needs. We're all really grasping at straws on a consistent basis. And everyone is feeling the effects, even the people that are above that income line, you know, or below. We all are experiencing the effects of that reality. So it's unfortunate. Yeah.
And the crazy thing is, we talked about, you know, those transitioning, coming off the street and
mm-hmm.
making a dollar more and getting everything cut off. You can make quite an argument that the household making that median income could use some support too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because depending on your situation, you could just be living hand to mouth, you know, filling the gaps in with credit or payday loans or different stuff like that. It's just, you know, it's just startling how the cost of living has gone up so much here mm-hmm. and other places in relation to the wages, which have barely budged. You know, it's, I mean, we could probably talk for hours about it, but it's a frustrating thing. It's a frustrating reality to confront, but mm-hmm. it's awesome that you're doing your part to support people.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think lifting as we climb is a big part of my I guess, values, wanting to feel like I'm not doing it for me, because I think we don't really individually win when, to your point, wages are not going up, cost of living and home prices and all the different indexes to measure where the economy is are indicating this huge upward trend, essentially a J curve, depending on, I guess, the timeline that you look at. But our wages have been really stagnant. And, you know, I can talk all day about, oh, I was able to buy these properties. And, you know, if I talked about income or whatever metrics for success I have for myself, if I'm participating in the same system that is also creating all this turmoil and all these challenges, I think you become a little bit too disconnected from reality. And it's important to bring those things together and understand that we have some responsibility to try to at least understand what's going on and how we can use our experiences, whether it's by example or to provide resources or support. That's the key. You know, being more fragmented and isolated and individualized is not the key.
Definitely, definitely. So the last question I have for you, take yourself back to that day mm-hmm. when you were foreclosed on growing up mm-hmm. and thinking about where you are now. You know, you have several properties, you'll be buying more, you're investing, you're helping people, you're an agent, you're doing very well.
Thank you.
How does it feel to be where you are now, reflecting back on that moment when you were younger?
No one's ever asked me that question. I mean, it's amazing. I feel very thankful and blessed. And I think that experience is what started my career. And I didn't know it would, of course, at that time. I felt like a real estate expert at the time because of moving so much. But there were so many things I didn't know, so many fears and insecurities that I had, and, you know, growing up and what's going to happen and where am I going to be. So it's nice to be able to look behind me at that time that I've spent just really investing in how to change certain narratives and realities. I'm thankful definitely for the perspective that some of the challenges I had growing up have given me, because I don't know if I would have the same level of motivation and consideration for all the different variables and realities if I hadn't been through that. So I feel good. I feel like there's a lot of momentum that hopefully will continue pulling me in the right direction and hopefully pulling a lot of people with me. So, yeah.
Absolutely. I love that. Love that. This has been a fantastic interview and we've gone all different types of directions, but mm-hmm. it's been a whole lot of fun. I really appreciate you taking some time to jump on the show. Please do let everyone know where they can find you, where they can follow you, where they can reach out to you if they want to connect.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's been awesome. My Instagram is Ila.one, Ila.one. My website is meetilab.com. You can find me on those platforms, and any other links or emails, et cetera, are all there. So I'm happy to be here and hopefully excited to connect with some of the viewers and listeners.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And thank you, everyone, so much for watching and listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue. If you're on YouTube, make sure you subscribe to the channel, like this video, share with someone who needs this information. If you're on the audio side, make sure you leave a 5-star rating and review. All of that takes you less than 10 seconds, so I definitely would appreciate it. Thank you all so much, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Black Real Estate Dialogue Podcast. Remember to follow us on Instagram at Black Real Estate Dialogue. And be sure to leave us 5 stars and a review on your favorite podcast listening platform. Until next time.
Hopefully this is the last time you'll hear this ad. Because with Chime checking account features like fee-free overdraft up to $200 with SpotMe and getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit, you can probably treat yourself to an ad-free upgrade to spend more time listening to your favorite podcasts, or at least grab yourself an extra morning latte this month. Join millions of Chime members who work on their financial progress with fee-free overdraft and no monthly fees. When you find new ways to save, you can reach your financial goals easier and still have the occasional treat. Take more control of your finances and say goodbye to monthly fees. Open your account in minutes at chime.com/goals24. That's chime.com/goals24. Chime. Feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Terms and conditions apply. Go to chime.com/disclosures for details.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic. But today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries. And with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton and adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride. Purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.